went down there and wound up speaking on the top of a car, you know, with an opener speech. And it was very moving to him because he came back and said, I haven't done that since Flint. And we later got a recording of it after my dad died because the Texas Rangers were there tape recording the speech.
But, was your father then that really started the liaison or support for the farm workers, or was this with Walter's approval, or did your father just...
Oh, no, he was definitely with Walter's approval, but I think my dad was the guy who actually went out there. But
thought it was a good idea.
Yeah.
What influence do you think your father had on Walter? Could anyone influence Walter?
Well, I think the stories I've heard are that my dad was the only Ruther who got along with George Meany. And I think that was, again, partly because his personality was less harsh than Walter's. But I also think they realized that on a larger political agenda, it was important to work together. And I guess I like to think that my dad was able to influence Walter about the need to work together on that. Mm-hmm. I do remember in 64, I guess, my dad talking about, I guess the union made $1 million contribution to the LBJ campaign, and my dad had the check, and how it sort of was hard to turn over the check. It never had $1 million check. I also remember the whole question of whether Humphrey was going to be picked to be the VP candidate, and my dad talking about how the LBJ folks were coming around saying, well, give us three names who would be acceptable. And they kept saying back, there aren't three names, there's just one name, because they know if they gave him three, they'd get the third choice rather than the first. And then there's actually one of the stories I vividly remember with Walter being at his house one evening, him talking about LBJ calling him up and saying, I'll give you six reasons why Humphrey can't be the nominee. And, you know, ADA background, no war record, he's not Catholic. And Walter said, give me a few minutes, I'll call you right back. And then he called back and, you know, rebutted each of the ones. And that's the type of story that made me so enthralled, hearing, you know, that type of interacting with LBJ on who's going to be the VP. I remember Walter talking about 68 convention, Humphrey calling him up about the VP selection, and this is after the riots and everything, and Walter saying to him, this should be the happiest day of my life, and I just want to cry. Because it was a dream come true to have Humphrey nominated.
Yeah, well, then I can see why those are, you know, major influences and heady times. The UAW in the 60s was powerful. And, I mean, if the president's concerned about what Walter and Roy think about Hubert Humphrey and reasons why and for and against, I should say, I mean, that is pretty, yeah, it's got to be pretty heady. So, as far as, if you compare yourself to your father, perhaps maybe that's unfair, but what I'm trying to get at is maybe what you see of yourself and your father or influence that he directly had on the way you operate. Is that a fair question?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say the maybe the softness, the seeing more that there may be two sides, being less abrasive, that I guess I like to think that came from him. I think we talked before about with my mother and my education, her helping me with that. I think a lot of skills came from her that way. I think one way I'm different than my dad, I think my father, like Victor, had the ability to more to let his emotions out when he was speaking, which, you know, I think is a tremendous ability. I've never really had that. I think people hearing me speak would say, well, he knows his stuff, he's really organized, but I don't think anyone would describe me as a passionate speaker. So I think my personality is different that way.
In your career, and eventually we will get to your personal career, but as long as we're on this crack, if you, this track, if you don't mind me asking, about other people who had influence on you, because as you've pointed out to us, you grew up with your parents, your uncles, and their friends who operated on the world stage. And not too many of us in America have that kind of influence growing up. And I wonder if there are other particular individuals that you would say had an influence on the way you operate, or had a philosophy you keep in mind as you work.
I talked before about my brother being a major influence, and we were intensely competitive, as I said, but we also remained close, and I've always looked to him for advice in different times. One of the things I most that I remember and thank him for it. I wanted to play basketball in high school. I was on the JV team. My junior year, I went up for the varsity, got cut. And then I did the debate because my brother had done the debate. Come the senior year, question is, do I make another run at going for the basketball team, or do I do debate? Because you couldn't do both. And I talked to one of the teachers I was close to, and the advice was, well, you should do debate because, you know, you're going to use those skills the rest of your life, which was true. And then I guess my brother was home from Michigan, and so I asked him, and he said, you should go out for basketball. You're never going to have another chance to do that in your life. You're going to be doing the debating the rest of your life.
Which is true, too.
And, I mean, I wanted to do the basketball, and he sort of gave me the rationale for why that was the right thing to do. And it was the right thing because that's where my heart was. And I did make the team. I didn't play very much, but I'm always glad I did that. So, and you know, at Michigan, I was a freshman. He was a senior, and he sort of broke me in. And I wound up beginning my sophomore year taking over the house where he had lived with other folks. And so it sort of had my place to stay because of him. And advice on courses, I, you know, take history of art classes. It's, you know, you'll learn something different. You know, I wound up loving it, to take, you know, sitting in a classroom looking at slides of pictures seemed like a pretty fun thing. Or, you know, advice my senior year, take something you would never otherwise take. I took a figure drawing class. So I definitely major influence. The fact that I became a CEO probably wouldn't have happened except my brother had already done that. Work-wise, I've had two mentors in my career. I started out working in the legal department, and John Fillion was the general counsel. And he was a wonderful man. And I guess I credit him with instilling in me a sense of ethics and integrity as a lawyer. I don't remember the details, but early on there was some point where we had to do some affidavit on something, and I wanted to sort of take some shortcut, and he was a stickler to, no, you can't do that. And and it was, at that time in the legal department, it wasn't just sort of churning through cases. We were given the freedom to think of doing test cases on different issues. Part of the time was turned into disasters, but it was really a great time to be working there as a lawyer. And I think I got excellent training, and I'm thankful for that he was there to guide me and be supportive. And eventually I was tired of being in Detroit, and I was attracted to politics. And so I asked to transfer to the Washington office, and he was supportive of that.
This was in 1982 that you transferred to the Washington office.
And I remember after I gotten the okay from John Fillion, going to see Doug to ask him about that. He said, oh, God, Stillman's been in here asking to transfer. And then I thought, oh, well, shoot, that's the end of it, because, you know, Stillman was a much higher level and a close confidant of Doug's at the time. And then, so it just sort of sat there. And then, and I didn't know people in the Washington office then. I just knew I was interested in politics and wanted to transfer. And then during negotiations at one point, I was over there because they had the lawyers, you know, staffing different issues. And Doug called me in and said, okay, he worked it out and he was going to transfer Stillman and me. And
so you've worked with Don Stillman here for nearly 30 years.
Well, we both came in 82. You know, Don was always in totally different area, the international affairs. Mm-hmm. Now, when he came, it was envisioned that he would be also the liaison to the Democratic administration, but, you know, what happened is we had a bunch of Republican administrations, so that part of the job, you know, for many years wasn't there at all. So, and Don would, because of the international affairs stuff and just his own personal desires, basically worked a night shift schedule. So day to day, we actually didn't have that much contact. When I came here, Dick Warden was the legislative director, and he's the other main mentor in my life, and probably in terms of my working career, the major influence. When I came here, for various internal political reasons, I kept the title of Associate General Counsel, but I really acted as a line lobbyist, and Dick pretty quickly began to rely on me a lot, and, you know, showed me the ropes and showed me how to be a lobbyist. And I mean, Dick had been on the Hill for Congressman Jim O'Hara, and then he was over at HHS as the, you know, top legislative guy under Califano, and then he had come back to the labor movement in the UAW. So he was just known by everybody. In fact, the early experience with him, at that time they allowed lobbyists to stand right off the House floor. They don't do that anymore. But, and there was a pecking order. Abby Dubrow had her little chair that the guards let her use it. But then Dick was sort of like the next senior lobbyist, and he'd stand, you know, first in line there, and the members would come in, and the members would stop to talk to him because they would ask him, okay, what's this procedural situation, what's going on? And, I mean, it was just fascinating, and everyone knew him, and it was great to watch. And, you know, he began to take me around all the time. He was always much better about that than I have been as director, in terms of, hey, why don't you come with me to this meeting? And I just had a tremendous education from him, and tremendously hard worker. Incorruptible. I mean, when he eventually retired, he was showered with offers from the corporate side to go lobby for them and didn't take any of it. The other thing, when I first came, it was August, and I had all these, you know, wool sport coats and suits. And, and the thing about Dick is he loved hot weather. He didn't use the air conditioning in his car. And so I would drive up to the hill, and by the time we got there, I'd just be drenched in sweat. He'd be like, this is great!
And you're a northern boy.
Yeah, yeah, my metabolism was different. But, well.
Let me ask one other question at this point, and maybe we'll take a little break then. Being a roofer was, in moving into work in the UAW, and as you pointed out, the only roofer who has, you know, second generation who did move into the world of the UAW, were you treated differently? Let me have a more open-ended question. Did being a roofer, how were you treated?
I mean, on the Hill, there were obviously a fair number of people who knew the name, made the connection, and so I think it made me more recognizable early on. I think also it was like, oh, this, you know, there's no question about where my heart lay. And you know, later on, speaking for the union, I think it helped me, gave me maybe more clout than I otherwise would have. You know, with Dick Warden. I mean, I was a very hard worker when I came, and I think I was a big help to him. Well, I know I was, because he had begged for someone to come and help him out because he was dying from the workload, and I knew none of that when I came. I just by myself. I knew I wanted to go to Washington. I wanted to do legislative stuff, but I guess I was fortunate that at the same time he was talking to Doug about, really need some help here, but I mean, maybe it also gave him more confidence in using me of, hey, I have a background in the union, I know the union.
I guess I was also curious as to your situation when you go to Solidarity House, the UAW headquarters, your first job in 77, here's a roofer, if it made any difference?
Well, it, two things. Early on in my career in the legal department, they started using me on sort of sensitive internal things. One, I remember there was a case of some of our people were involved with CETA contracts, you know, falsifying people and getting paid for that, and I was the person who went out to investigate. And I do. It led to, when we uncovered it, you know, we were able to prove it. Doug Frazier fired the rep who was involved. And I vividly remember meeting with Doug and the regional director. You know, they had reasons. Oh, if you fire him, it's, you know, that'll be bad. And Doug just cut him off. This guy's guilty of corruption, and he's gone. I always tremendously admired Doug for that. But there was a series of things like that, and they obviously were using me because they figure the background, it's sensitive. And I finally went to John Filling and said, please, enough. I don't want to do just a diet of this type of thing. And but I think that's one way it influenced. Another thing, early on, one of my jobs was campaign finance, and I became a guy in the legal department who advised our cap reps about the campaign laws, so early on I sort of gravitated towards the political end of things. One just... just the whole picture, because it wasn't unanimous, 100% admiring. I talked about having flown from my law school graduation out to the convention on my first day on the job. So I get to the hotel and, you know, registering, checking in with the UAW, and I run into a guy named Dan Luria, a lefty who used to be in the research department, and get introduced to him. And his words to me, which I still remember, were, Ruther, blood is poison.
Damn, before you even
yes.
started.
But, well, that's a different perspective. Not what I expected on my first day with the UAW.
It's a great story. Well, since we've spoken quite a bit about a number of personalities, I think I'd like to continue on that vein. You are in a unique position, if we consider your childhood, that you have worked with every president of the UAW since Walter Ruther. Obviously, your first encounter was working directly for Doug Frazier, but you knew Leonard Woodcock, you knew Walter Ruther, and obviously you knew Ruther better than Woodcock. So we've spoken about Walter Ruther. I wonder if we could actually go through the presidents and perhaps some other folks like other union leaders, because you had mentioned Weinberg earlier, Nat Weinberg. So I wondered if maybe we can talk about, I guess, two different shifts. If we could go through the presidents, and then we'll step back again, and maybe you could talk about a couple other. So starting with Leonard Woodcock.
Well, I probably knew him least of all. My first day on the job was the convention where he retired. So I never really had experience working with Leonard. My knowledge of him was as a kid, seeing him around my uncle or my dad, or seeing him at UAW meetings. But, from what I was told by folks, everyone admired his intellect tremendously and his dedication. I think he was also very hard-nosed, could be very profane. I'm told he liked his scotch an awful lot. And also mostly stories about him being very much of a loner. Very different from Doug's personality and the warmth that Doug had.
Well, you sort of began work on the day Doug became president.
Yeah.
Maybe a couple days
before. Two days before.
2 days before. So, yeah, speak about Doug Frazier a bit.
I already told the story of his firing the staffer who had been found guilty of corruption, and I mean that strength and integrity always stayed with me. Doug was so good on his feet, so smart. I mean, when he would speak, you would see he wouldn't have a text. He spoke from just a handful of notes, and but was a tremendous speaker. I remember also talking with Don Stillman at our PR guys. You know, Doug would tell a Polish joke at a press conference he was having and get away with it, because for him it was sort of authentic. And I also remember, this was as a young lawyer, some dissidents had